Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Square One Printing, 630 West, 200 North, in Logan. Personalized printing for home, school, or business, including banners, business cards, letterhead, envelopes, brochures, flyers, and calendars. Information at squareoneprinting.com.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today is Columbus Day. Towns and regions and one nation are named for the famed explorer. For many Native Americans, of course, Columbus was not a hero, but a harbinger of genocide. And the man himself is complicated. Today, my guest is Lawrence Berggren, author of Columbus, The Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504. The New York Times says Lawrence Berggren's Columbus was brilliant, audacious, volatile, paranoid, and ruthless. What emerges in this biography is a surprising and revealing portrait of a man who might have been the title character in a Shakespearean tragedy. We're going to ask you what you think of Columbus the Man, Columbus the Holiday. The number to call us is 1-800-826-1495. Or you can join us via email to upraxis@gmail.com. Lawrence Berggren, a pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Thanks very much. Nice talking with you, Tom.
You have written biographies of Magellan, Marco Polo, Columbus. Yeah. It seems this is an interest of yours.
Explorers, yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed. They're all connected. Marco Polo actually inspired Magellan and Columbus, as unlikely as it sounds, because they both read his account of his travels. And were both went off to sail over water in search of China, which he went to over land mostly.
Yeah, you're right that Columbus read, I guess, the travels of Marco Polo somewhat more naively than others did. He saw it as direct travelogue, travel guide.
Yes, he actually marked it as almost as a kind of a shopping list or trip advisor about things to do in China and things to bring back, such as gold or spices and people to see. And he seems to have forgotten that Marco Polo was writing two centuries earlier. So a lot of the features he was writing about, assuming that Columbus could even have gotten there, which was virtually impossible, were gone, especially the towering figure of Kublai Khan, who was the emperor of a large part of Asia at that point, was long gone, and the Mongol Empire, which he had ruled, was also in disarray. So if by some magic Columbus had gotten there, he would not have found the world that Marco Polo described. Nevertheless, Marco Polo didn't exert this hypnotic fascination on so much of the West, and his book was sort of the general idea of what the East was like and what Asia was like. So, as we all know, the discovery of the Americas, including the USA, was just a byproduct of this other search, which was a search by Europeans to get to Asia.
And you write that Columbus's plan was audacious, but it was simple. I'm going to travel to the Canary Islands and thence west,
right.
And I'm going to find, I believe I can find China. How mainstream or not mainstream was this idea that I can reach China, reach the Orient through the sea route?
It was sort of a mainstream beliefs among navigators and sailors of his era, and it was not exactly group thought, but it was conventional wisdom. That's the word I'm looking for. And Columbus was a man of the Renaissance, of the early Renaissance. He was a brilliant navigator. He had, ever since he was a young man, plied the Mediterranean Sea and actually sailed as far north as England and Ireland, perhaps even reached Iceland as a young navigator. It was warmer then. So he had some experience with navigation. As a person, as a potential leader or administrator of a colony, which he became, that was entirely a different story, and that's the tragic part of his legacy. But he proposed this plan really as a kind of a get-rich-quick scheme. At first, he was Italian, of course. He was from Genoa. which was a seafaring city-state. But he proposed a scheme at first to the king of Portugal, as we all know, who dangled him for years and years and years and finally said no, and it was very exasperating and frustrating for Columbus, who had married a Portuguese wife by then in hopes of advancing his fortunes in that country. And then he moved on to Spain. Why Spain? Well, Spain was becoming kind of the go-to place for explorers and would-be explorers, and Ferdinand and Isabella, who we also remember from school, who were the regents ruling Spain, were commissioning people like Columbus to go find these new lands and bring back riches to Spain, which badly needed them. This was coming right on the heels of the Spanish Inquisition. In fact, Columbus wound up leaving the day after that became the law of the land, but there was a long run-up, and the Inquisition, which banished both Muslims and Jews from the Iberian Peninsula, and also impoverished Spain both materially and artistically, culturally, and intellectually. So they were almost desperate for somebody to fill up this vacuum that they had created. That's what impelled Spain to send out explorers like Columbus, and that's where he found a welcome reception for his plan, which I have to tell you, even at that time, was a pretty flimsy plan. It was as sophisticated as anybody's, but if it sounds like he wanted to go on a wing and a prayer, that's pretty much it. Other people had tried this before him. So far as we know, nobody ever came back. So you have to give him credit for extraordinary daring. Or courage, if nothing else.
Yeah, extraordinary. I wonder if you could take us to, and this is a sort of a pulse-pounding description that you write, the days, the moments before they sighted land. The atmosphere is pretty grim, and he's facing, I think, the real possibility of mutiny.
Yes, not unusual for sailors, captains like him, to face mutiny. And the voyage across had been, of course, anxiety-ridden because he didn't know where he was going. And the maps that he had were useless. He was in uncharted waters. There was no way to be in contact with anyone. And he kept expecting to find some evidence of China, something he had read in Marco Polo, but nothing fit. And he kept trying to somehow rearrange what he was seeing with descriptions in Marco Polo or some maps that he had, but he was getting really lost. Now, some of the sailors, there were three ships, of course, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. Some of the sailors in the other ships were getting mutinous, were having other ideas about what they should be doing, and they were preparing to either imprison Columbus, take him prisoner, or kill him, and then sail back to Spain to save their own lives. They thought he was being reckless and getting them killed. It was a fairly fast crossing. It was less than a month. So they weren't beginning to die of starvation and scurvy and things like that. It hadn't been that long, but they did believe they were sailing off into the unknown, and the shape of the earth, the size of the earth, wasn't as well known as we know now. That had been known by the ancients, but that was all lost knowledge. So they thought they might be sailing on and on and on forever and just get lost in kind of in fogs and never be able to come back. So Columbus did not inspire trust in his sailors. Also, you have to keep in mind the caliber of the men he brought. These were not trained sailors or navigators, with very few exceptions. There were some pilots who were experienced. They were mostly convicts who had been pressed into service. So they were unruly and had no interest or particular investment in this voyage. Anyway, it was something that this, as far as they were concerned, this was just a trip to certain death, and they were going to die and on sea and instead of on land. So they were not filled with any sense of mission or patriotic endeavor, unlike Columbus, who did feel that God had somehow given it to him to undertake this mission and felt that he was going to, at some point, come upon a discovery that would lead him to China. Of course, he wasn't anywhere near China. He was actually in the Caribbean. At one point, one of his sailors, his lookout, thought he saw a distant island. To this day, there's debate about which island in the Caribbean it was exactly. Then it disappeared, and then eventually it appeared again. And they did finally touch land and made a safe landing. So their lives were saved. Columbus's life was saved, but that opened up a whole new series of problems, which was, where were they? We now know they were probably on the island of Samana Cay in the Caribbean, but there are some other contenders in that area of the Caribbean, which is dotted with hundreds of small islands. But he thought he was somehow near China, and that the Earth was a lot smaller than we now know it to be. So, the discovery of land on that first voyage by Columbus amounted to an accident. He didn't understand where he was. And of course, we know the great irony of Columbus. We all say, who was Columbus? And there's, Columbus cities and Columbus towns and Columbus roads and Columbus statues, not only all over the United States, but all over a good part of the world, certainly in the Americas and in Europe. But he never discovered America as we know it, and he never even knew it existed. In his entire life, he never knew the continent of North America existed. All he knew were these islands, eventually Cuba, which he encountered, Central America, which he eventually encountered. That was as far as he went. So it's possible he might have glimpsed the coast of some of the islands off Key West on one of his voyages, but he never suspected that there was a great continent to the north. If he had come back today, he would be flabbergasted by several things. First of all, the discoveries that are attributed to him through a series of quirks and accidents that he had nothing to do with. And the second thing is, I think he would be deeply, deeply troubled by his reputation, which is, as you mentioned earlier on, as genocidal. I'm happy to talk about what that means. But, he saw himself as a bringer of religious salvation to any people he encountered, rather than the genocide part, which also was unintentional, tragically unintentional byproduct of these voyages.
We're talking with Lawrence Berggren. He's author of Columbus, The Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504. Today is Columbus Day, and we're looking at that, the reputation of Columbus, and whether some people say we shouldn't even be celebrating Columbus Day. Of course, for many Native Americans, Columbus is a great symbol of the genocide that happened, intentional or not. We're throwing out those questions to you and learning about Columbus the man, who is a very complicated figure. We'll learn a bit more about that and get into, after following a break, we'll get into what the effect was.
A lengthy biographical sketch of him. I think we'll come to understand that he never really saw himself as a conqueror or military figure. He was not a conquistador, as some of the conquerors were who came right after him. And he saw himself as a sailor who somehow turned into a mystical sailor, let's put it that way. And and his mission, he saw, was primarily religious, but he also wanted to bring back enough gold, which he expected to find in China, turned out to be the New World, that would make him wealthy and make others wealthy, especially Ferdinand and Isabella. He did not succeed in that mission, and he found himself the victim of copycats, of a lot of skullduggery, and his own limitations as a navigator and as a person. He was one of these people who was a zealot, and it was very difficult for him to process and incorporate the new information that he was acquiring. For example, he didn't think of himself as a discoverer. all he saw himself as being was someone who was retracing Marco Polo's route, but going over water instead of over land. And he was looking for an old world, not a new world. And so that's, you know, the difference between what we think of Columbus today and what he thought of himself then is extreme. And there is a lot of truth in fact. Why Columbus? Why should he be honored given his confusion, let alone the inadvertent mayhem that he touched off? And getting back to the question of what was he like, I think as a younger man, he was a little more interesting and flexible and malleable. He's sometimes depicted as a humble, illiterate sailor who stumbled into this venture, but that's not really the case. He was well-educated in Genoa in navigational school. His father was a well-connected local politician who was eventually on the wrong side of a very bitter feud between two warring political factions and had to leave Genoa and move out into the hills. So Columbus was raised to be a sophisticated navigator, which was a major enterprise in Genoa and the way that city prospered. And knew Latin. He may have known some other languages. Actually had an appreciation for some of the foreign peoples whom he encountered along the way. One thing that was constant was his the fact that he was very devout, and the sense of mission or divine mission was something that stayed with him for a long time. He even had visions about it and had heard voices talking to him about what his mission should be. Today, to a psychiatrist, that might throw up a red flag and say, oh, people who hear voices, you know, are really meant to have some serious mental issues. However, in Columbus's time, a lot of people heard voices speaking to them. And he was one of many. It was more common than we would think of it today. It was not necessarily an aberration. It was more of a sign of faith. Columbus was also very restless. You know, he was willing to move from Genoa all up and down the Mediterranean and then on to Portugal and then finally on to Spain and to risk not one but four voyages to the New World. If he had lived longer, and he died in Spain shortly after he returned as a broken man from his fourth voyage, there's no question he would have gone on a fifth voyage or a sixth voyage if he could have found the backing for it. So he really put his all into this tragic venture.
You say his big achievement is the permanent connecting of the two worlds.
I think so, because although he didn't really plan to, he somehow planned to build or find a lifeline to China. After his voyage, from then on, Europe and the New World were permanently connected. It never was. They've only grown closer over the years. We're aware of the Columbian exchange of things as dreadful or harmful, potentially, as germs, but also livestock, flora, and fauna. Some wonderful things as well as some very dreadful things. Of course, there's always a debate or discussion about the fact that Columbus wasn't the first to discover the New World. Well, of course he wasn't. There were people who we now call indigenous people, the Taino Indians, who had been there since time immemorial. It was their land. There may have been others who made it to the New World before Columbus from Europe. There may have been Vikings who came there first. And there are other theories, but none of them left any kind of permanent mark on the land. Columbus came there, and around Cuba and the Caribbean, he built forts. He left people there. He established outposts. Because he was a big writer and proselytizer and pamphleteer, he established the idea of the New World in the European consciousness, especially in Spain. So everything was different when his impression really lasted, he brought back indigenous people, Indians, to Europe. Some of them survived, most of them perished in the climate, And so he fostered this exchange without realizing the consequences, some of the harmful consequences of what it could be. I'm thinking especially of germs. When we talk about genocide, it leaves the impression that Columbus and his well-armed men went out and slaughtered indigenous peoples in the New World, Indians by the hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands, but that wasn't the case. They were either unarmed or had very little in the way of weapons, and what they brought with them with their livestock was germs. And of course nobody knew about germs at that point, and it was germs that went through the indigenous population like wildfire and decimated them. And when there were hundreds of thousands of them by the time of Columbus's first voyage, by the time he finished, there were only hundreds of thousands of them. But not because Columbus intentionally slaughtered them. He was really upset and appalled by the and baffled by this death that he saw going on around him without realizing that he had inadvertently contributed to it through germs, because nobody knew about germs then, and Indians and indigenous peoples hadn't developed resistance to common European-style germs, just as the Europeans hadn't developed resistance to common germs in the New World. There was one other tragic offshoot of this, again, that Columbus hadn't anticipated. At first, the indigenous peoples welcomed him as the fulfillment of a prophecy that many of them had had. We know this from writings that many of Columbus's men had left, and they were greeted as a fulfillment or savior of men with large ships from the sky who would come to visit. But they overstayed their welcome. When it became apparent to the Indians that Columbus's men were staying, their feelings about them changed, because they felt that Columbus and his men were stealing the Indians' land, their ancestral lands, and they didn't look kindly on that. Now, of course, there was plenty of land to go around, but Columbus's men, and they were just a handful of them, we're only talking about a few hundred, were doing more than that. Eventually, they found the Indian women, the indigenous peoples, women, very, very attractive, very beguiling, very seductive. They made an effort to extend their idea of hospitality to Columbus's men. Soon they were mating with them. Once the Indians saw that, they were appalled and disheartened, because they felt that Columbus's men were literally stealing their future away, because they were creating a new breed of person who was neither Indian, neither Taino Indian, nor European. They reacted in a startling and disheartening, tragic way. They committed suicide. Many of them, tens of thousands, started jumping off of cliffs or eating poison roots and herbs and died that way. Again, Columbus wasn't clear about what he had done to contribute to this tragedy. He was aware of it. He was baffled and disheartened, lacked the wherewithal to figure out what was going on. And it was yet another facet of this unfolding tragic and cultural encounter, accidental cultural encounter between the two continents. Nevertheless, you know, life went on, and the transfer went on over the centuries.
We're talking with Lawrence Berggren, author of a description of Columbus's four voyages, description of the man. We're going to take a break. When we come back in just a minute, we'll talk more about Columbus and the joining of the two cultures following this.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, with a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches, and USU Human Resources.
The Be Well Moment is made possible by the USU Department of Human Resources Wellness Program at usu.edu/HR.
October is National Depression Awareness Month. Depression is a common but serious illness. Do not be ashamed if you believe or feel that you may have depression. Here are some useful tips when dealing with common symptoms. Get a depression screening done if you are feeling down. It is better to get checked than to sit and wait. The sooner you seek treatment, the better your outlook will be. Treat problems such as insomnia or sleep apnea to help ease your symptoms. Eat healthy. A good diet rich in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and fish may help battle depression. Learn to walk away. Depression can cloud your judgment. Try taking a deep breath and make decisions about a topic when you begin to feel better. Remember, depression does not have to be a normal part of life. With the right steps and a positive attitude, you can overcome it. This is Nicole Jackson for the Be Well program at Utah State University. Be well, Utah.
You're listening to Access Utah. Today on Columbus Day, we're talking about Columbus and his legacy. Towns and regions, even one nation, Colombia, are named for the famed explorer. Of course, for many Native Americans, Columbus is not a hero, but a harbinger of genocide. The man himself is a complicated figure, and we're talking with Lawrence Bergreen, author of Columbus, The Four Voyages, on the program today. Lawrence Bergreen, we've been talking about the legacy, and I'm wondering where you think Columbus should fit in that. Does he bear all, of course, he doesn't bear all the responsibility. He is the symbol, however, of the joining of the two two cultures, the two civilizations. Yes. And it probably would have happened, you know, sooner or later.
Yes.
Maybe,
yes.
You know, it was always going to have disastrous consequences.
Yes. Yes. I think anybody who had done what Columbus did about that time, it would have come to more or less the same result. We know because there were lots of other Columbuses around, i.e. explorers who were coming, sailing mostly from Spain, who went to the New World and had approximately the same experiences that Columbus did. They just did not, over time, become the symbol that Columbus has become for us. Columbus was not even the best known of these explorers in that time. Yes, he had this backing from Ferdinand Isabella, but so did other explorers. Some of them were more successful in the sense that they were able to bring back more booty, more gold to Spain. Part of the reason that I think Columbus is sort of towers above them in our consciousness. Well, it's a kind of a collection of accidents. Partly he wrote a lot about his adventures. So we have letters, long letters that he wrote where he proclaims his triumphs. Other sailors who went with him also wrote long accounts of it. He also wrote to a lot of clergy because he was devout and was actually a minor order of a monk during all of these about his encounters. So they wrote, and those clergy on land wrote accounts about Columbus's adventures based on his own descriptions. So, and then there are a lot of official Spanish documents. So his voyages are very well documented. That's how we know what they were doing virtually on a daily basis, and that's how I was able to write about what happened on each of these four voyages. I saw them as all part of a unit, and remarkably enough, on the fourth voyage, which was only a decade after the first, his teenage son went along and in later life wrote an account of it. So we actually have a kind of a family father-son explorer saga going with Columbus's accounts and then his son recollecting what it was like to sail with his father, the Admiral Columbus. This son was named Ferdinand. Also, we saw it through his eyes. He was a little bit different from Columbus. He was a little more impressionistic. He was perhaps even more concerned about the welfare of the indigenous peoples than Columbus was. And in later life, he became a book collector and historian. He was not an explorer. So he looked at things with a somewhat more objective eye, and also keep in mind we're celebrating Columbus Day and we're talking about Columbus Day today. However, Columbus Day is a very recent invention, and you mentioned that many American Indians would rather do without Columbus Day entirely. That's certainly true also in Venezuela, where Columbus has become a kind of unsubject and unperson, and there's no Columbus Day in Venezuela, unlike many other Latin American countries. But that was also the case in the United States. It was only when FDR became president That he wanted to make a gesture that would endear him to Italian-American voters, because he wanted that bloc to be part of his New Deal, that he proposed the idea of a federal holiday called Columbus Day. And so we've only celebrated it since then, not even for 100 years, only 80 years. So there was a time before Columbus Day. Now, earlier, but before then, before there was an official holiday of Columbus Day, the likes of which we're celebrating these days with parades and things, there were Italian-American organizations that banded together and had parades marking Columbus's achievement in, you know, in various cities around the United States before then. So there was some precedent for it. But our idea of, you know, the Columbus Day we all know is a very recent invention. And also, I guess this is in the spirit of Columbus, one based on political expediency. And again, I just want to repeat, Columbus never even knew that America, i.e. North America, existed, and certainly never discovered it, never set foot on any American, North American territory, and would have been flabbergasted by what's happened in his name since then.
Columbus, as you describe him, he's interesting in that, well, in many aspects, but one interested me. He seems to be able to, and I don't know if this is strength or weakness, to sort of live in his illusions.
Yes, well put.
And he of course he was determined that this was, you know, that this was China, right? And yes. Despite all evidence to the contrary, yeah. In fact, the second voyage he turned around very quickly, I think, to prove it.
Yes, he was expecting to hear either Chinese spoken on some of his voyages, or he'd even brought some translators along in case they heard biblical languages. You may say, why biblical languages? I think I mentioned that Columbus's idea of chronology was flexible at best, and he thought perhaps he would encounter lands he had read about in the Bible. Because he was a student of the Bible, and perhaps he would encounter people speaking ancient biblical languages. He was prepared for any eventuality except for the one that he actually encountered. It was very difficult for him to process and understand what he was seeing, and he was unable to appreciate it, and then also unable to make others understand what he had actually found. Columbus also was extremely stubborn. So not only was he kind of unable to change his point of view, you had mentioned he, you know, kind of lived out in his illusions. He had a lot of hallucinations, particularly on his later voyage. It's not clear why he was hallucinating, but we know he was because he wrote down some of his adventures and encounters in hallucination. At one point, he talks about when he was on his third voyage, sailing just off the coast of South America, and he believed he was sailing uphill. Which, of course, is possible. And then he believed that if he kept sailing far enough uphill, he would reach the entrance to heaven, that this was a terrestrial entrance to heaven that one could reach if one sailed far enough in the proper direction. And he also often had hallucinations about voices speaking to him, and even the voice of God. Again, we know about this because Columbus wrote down his impressions and the words, and so we, you know, we get the sense of a visionary. Now, it's possible at that point that he was ill, or maybe he had just refined his faith to the point where it had become extremely overpowering to him. But in any case, it was not shared by other people on the voyages. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there was almost a mutiny on the first voyage, and it had been abandoned because he discovered land. But mutiny was always a possibility on the later voyages as well, and there was, in a sense, mutiny at home in Spain because there were many enemies who were trying to persuade Ferdinand and Isabella to cut off Columbus completely. They were rivals who considered him a charlatan, or they were just plain rivals, and they wanted to grab a piece of this pie, this gold rush, quite literally a gold rush, before Columbus did. I just want to talk about gold for a second. This exerted a really powerful mystical influence on Europeans of that era. And Columbus was certainly no stranger to that, and he expected he would find unimaginable amounts of gold in, quote, China or the New World. He didn't. He did find some gold, and when he encountered the Taino Indians and others there, they were often wearing gold jewelry in their ears and their noses and necklaces around their necks, very wide bands, and that encouraged him to think that, you know, somewhere he was going to find gold mines, and that would, of course, rescue Spain from its financial crisis, make him wealthy beyond imagining. But he never did, because he just found gold washings, the gold that rain had washed out from the hillsides, but never found a major seam of gold or anything like a gold mine. And that myth that the New World was the golden land, that there was a, you know, gold to be found somewhere in them thar hills or somewhere, it actually kept going until the gold rush in 1848, 1849. That finally reached its apotheosis centuries later. But in the late 15th century, in 1492 through 1502, when Columbus was sailing, that gold myth was a very, very potent one. One of the arrangements that Columbus had made with Ferdinand and Isabella in a document known as the Capitulation was that he would become the ruler of all the lands that he discovered, rule the people, and also take as much of the gold or products of his land as he wanted. So once they eventually realized how much territory he discovered, all these islands in the Caribbean, and eventually large swaths of Central America, it dawned on Ferdinand and Isabella and their advisors that Columbus might actually wind up ruling a kingdom larger and more wealthy and more populous than theirs, you know, in Spain. So they violated their own commitment to him, and they cut him down to size, and they didn't give him all the things that he felt he was entitled to the first time. And he thought it was very unfair and protested mightily against it. But they were the sovereigns, and, you know, they were the ones who had made the document with him, and so they could all on their own change it, which is what they did. Had Columbus lived longer, he would have been still extraordinarily wealthy, but he wouldn't have been a ruler of their, you know, able to rival them. Which brings me to another subject. The other side of Columbus, the dark side is, well, the bright side is Columbus's intuitive genius as a narrator, as a navigator, which was extraordinary and helped him make four voyages safely with little loss of life at sea. But then there was his really tragic, inept, clumsy handling of these, what are in fact colonies that he discovered, all the loss of life that he triggered, his inability to handle his own sailors and soldiers who went with him. So, to put it mildly, Columbus was not a people person. Mm. And it's as if we found some explorer or mountain climber or airplane pilot or astronaut who went to a new land or climbed a mountain, which was an extraordinary accomplishment that they had trained their whole lives for. But then we asked them to administer it and to rule it and deal with the people there and to bring peace with it and to establish trade relations. And you would say, well, wait a second, this person is a mountain climber or an airplane pilot or something. That's not part of that, of their skill set. And the same thing applied to Columbus. He was now asked to perform something which was totally different, which was running a colony. And he was not a soldier, not a politician, didn't really know how to turn to anybody else who was, and was way, way out of his depth in trying to do that. Not that there was anybody else around who was any better at it. There were others who tried, and there were many other captains who eventually got to the New World and tried to do the same thing and ran into many of the same problems. These were two really separate functions, explorer and, I don't know what you'd call it, administrator, if you will, or even ruler or political leader, but they were entirely separate. In Columbus's mind and in his day, they were somehow fused, which did not lead to a happy outcome.
We're going to take another brief break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Lawrence Berggren. He's author of a biography, or at least a description of the four voyages of Columbus. The book is Columbus, the Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504. Appropriate topic, we thought, for Columbus Day. More following the break.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think,
we've
feel,
had to believe in impossible
things. Infinite possibility and that sense of potential. And I realize
and we've had to refuse
persist
to fear failure.
You've got to persist through failure.
You can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming to Utah Public Radio, Mondays.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting The Marvelous Wonderettes with two other productions through October 2013 in Cedar City, www.bard.org, and the USU Army ROTC Wounded Warrior 5K October 19th. Proceeds to benefit training efforts including uniforms and training aids. Registration and check-in at 9 a.m. The cannon fires and the race starts at 10 a.m. Details at usu.edu/armyrotc.
You're listening to Access Utah, and on Columbus Day, we're talking about Columbus. Lawrence Berggren is my guest. He's author of Columbus, The Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504. Very interesting look at the adventure, the voyages, and the very conflicted, interesting man who was Christopher Columbus. Lawrence Berggren, let me quote just a little bit from the book. You say, Columbus held up a mirror to the old world, revealing and magnifying its inhumanity and greed, along with its piety, curiosity, and exuberance. Columbus's voyages revealed many harsh truths about the limits of human understanding. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about Bartolomé de las Casas. He was shocked and appalled in contemporaneous writings about Columbus, other explorers' treatment of the Indians, and that certainly has become our view in contemporary days. Where does Columbus fit on that? What responsibility does he bear?
Las Casas was for your readers. First sailed with Columbus as a soldier, eventually stayed on, was appalled by the treatment that the indigenous people, the Taíno, the Indians, were receiving at the hand of the Europeans, and then also eventually became a priest and took up his work. His pastoral work was not only bringing the natives, the people whom he encountered, to Christianity, but really what we would call social work. He was trying to tend to their needs, and he lived on into his early 90s in the New World, and then wrote an account of what he called the destruction of the Indies, as Columbus's findings were known. And it was an indictment of not only Columbus personally, who he considered to be just a hapless cog in a imperialistic machine, but of the entire Spanish imperial enterprise. He's now perhaps what we might call a whistleblower or humanitarian, talking about the indignities that were being accomplished in Spain's name or in the name of Christianity, and he considered them to be outrages, that this kind of brutality and violence was being done in the name of a religion, a belief, in a way that was supposed to be the opposite of all of this. So it was a voice of conscience that was one that sounds very familiar today. And it's a very modern voice, even though Las Casas, although he lived much longer than Columbus, was a contemporary of Columbus. Anyway, he wrote extensively about it. There was a pamphlet he wrote, this a short account of the destruction of the Indies, which was very popular as a kind of a call, a warning about the harmful effects, even in Columbus's time, of his voyages. And then he also wrote a much, much longer account, which was very thorough and fairly scholarly about, and it was sort of nuanced. It wasn't just a condemnation, but it was a kind of a very disillusioned appreciation at first hand, because he had seen this much of this with his own eyes or heard about it from the participants of Columbus's voyages and many of the harmful effects. Las Casas, in addition to Columbus, is one of our best sources for the voyages, partly because we get a completely different point of view from him, partly because of his own personal journey from soldier to priest, and the way his view of the Taino evolves, which is really fascinating. And it stands as an important counterpoint to Columbus's kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, monochromatic view of things. Las Casas was not a visionary. He didn't hear voices. He didn't necessarily think that God was telling him what to do the way that Columbus did, but he was scholarly and he was a person of conscience, and he was trying to the extent that he could, remedy some of the harm that he saw that Columbus's voyages had created.
Here's an email from Steve in Beaver Dam, Arizona. He emailed to upraxis@gmail.com. You can as well. The phone number, by the way, is 1-800-826-1495 if you'd like to respond to the program. Here is Steve's email, several paragraphs. He says, well, indeed, it was germs and despair which depopulated the Caribbean so very quickly after Columbus arrived, but the Tainos were only the very first to be exterminated, and many, many millions died or were brutally enslaved by the conquistadors who came fast on Columbus's heels. Yes. True, the conquest by disease continued to be a theme, but the Europeans bound up a self-justifying belief that they were bringing the true religion to these original Americans with an ideology of a rapacious exploitation. While the European conquerors murdered and enslaved in the Caribbean, Central and South America, and eventually North America too, they debated among themselves whether or not these people they so brutally exploited were in fact human beings or were some lesser species. Either way, they treated them like chattel, and only after they had depopulated the indigenous people did they turn to Africa as a source of slaves. So it's an interesting comment, very apropos to the discussion we were just having.
Actually, they had turned earlier to Africa because Africa was closer, and the Portuguese had the, I guess, rather dubious distinction of being pioneers in this area, because they simply sailed down the coast to Africa. The Portuguese were desperately short of manpower for their country and for their empire and their expansionist dreams. So they were among the first to bring slaves back to Europe, and they were perhaps, I don't know, more wholeheartedly endorsed the idea of slavery as something that they wanted to keep pursuing. Columbus also, when Columbus grew up, this whole idea of slavery is so fascinating. When Columbus grew up in Genoa, he was surrounded by slavery because many Italians at that time owned slaves. They owned servants. We would call them indentured servants, or if they were women, concubines. They would put them up in their houses or in separate houses. They were often slaves from the East. So they were Asian, or they were from Eastern Europe. And they were a very common feature of life in Italy and much of Europe at that time. So Columbus was familiar with a caste system or slavery from his upbringing in Genoa, as were so many other people. And so what he thought he might be doing when he was thinking about bringing slaves back to the New World was a kind of variation on the system that he had grown up with in Genoa. It really didn't work out, of course. Mm. And the whole question of slavery was a vexed one, because it wasn't that so much if they the Europeans considered the Taino or indigenous peoples to be a kind of lower order of people or not fully human. But theologically speaking, if they were slaves, they could not be saved. They could not be Christians. So it was either one or the other. The most Europeans, but not all, preferred that they would be saved, that they would be Christians. And therefore, they could not be slaves. They could not be treated as chattel. Nevertheless, there were enough people who were, had low enough intentions that they were still trying to figure out some way to exploit this source of manpower. It was a very, very vexed problem, and certainly Columbus did not shine any light on it. It was left to people like Lacasis, who were, to bring some sense of morality to it, or, clear thinking about it.
We have reached near the end of our time, just have about a minute left. And I wonder what on a Columbus Day like today, what do you reflect on? What are your thoughts?
Well, because of what we've been talking about, it's really, for me, a somber, sober day of reflection of the unfortunate outcome of idealism sometimes, moral obtuseness. So I reflect about what we can learn from it to benefit from not just by trying to feel better about ourselves, but benefit from by living better, by living more, happily and more fully. But I also feel a sense of wonder about it, because while all this was going on, and you get this from Columbus's journals and other journals all the time, the sense of wonder at the encounter with another world was so magical and so marvelous and so mysterious. It's like our encounter with other worlds, other planets in outer space. Languages and fruits and vegetables and lands that nobody had seen before, that nobody had guessed could guess. It would just show the endless variety of nature and splendor and to them God's creation. So it was, to paraphrase Dickens, the best of times in that sense, and also the worst of times.
We'll leave it there. Out of time. Lawrence Bergreen has been my guest. The book is Columbus, The Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, Tom.
And join me, of course, tomorrow for Access Utah. For producer Bennett Purser, I'm Tom Williams. Thanks so much for listening today. Dr. Zorba Pastor from Zorba Pastor on Your Health is coming to Utah. Dr. Pastor will give a free presentation titled Three Simple Steps to Ultimate Health on Friday, October 18th at Moab Regional Hospital. His address will be followed by a reception. Space is limited, so go to upr.org for registration information. Zorba Pastor will headline other events in Moab and Logan. You can find out more about those at upr.org. And Zorba Pastor's visit in Moab is sponsored by USU Moab and Moab Regional Hospital.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the 11th Annual Moab Folk Festival, November 1st through the 3rd, featuring artists David Lindley, The Steel Wheels, Marley's Ghost, Moores and McCumber, and others, food vendors and arts and crafts from around the globe. More at moabfolkfestival.com. And USU Athletics, offering Aggie basketball season tickets, including all 20 home games and the BYU game in Salt Lake City. Information is at utahstateaggies.com or at the USU Spectrum ticket office.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.